Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. With multiple states considering new abortion restrictions, many legal analysts foresee a challenge to Roe v. Wade reaching the Supreme Court in the near future. President Trump has put two conservative justices on the court since taking office, and as a candidate, he talked about how his nominees could reverse Roe. Here he is in a 2016 debate moderated by Fox News' Chris Wallace.
I am pro-life, and I will be appointing pro-life judges. I would think that that will go back to the individual states.
But I'm asking you specifically, would you
If they overturned it, it'll go back to the states.
But what I'm asking you, sir, is do you want to see the court overturn? You just said you want to see the court protect the Second Amendment. Do you want to see the court overturn Roe v.
Well, if we put another two or perhaps three justices on, that's really what's going to be that will happen, and that'll happen automatically.
So, is it as automatic as Trump suggests? And what about other landmark decisions on Citizens United, same-sex marriage, or the Second Amendment? On the line with us now to talk about the current court and how the Supreme Court has interpreted the Constitution throughout history is Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig. His new book is called Fidelity and Constraint, How the Supreme Court Has Read the American Constitution. Larry Lessig, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you. And I understand that you started working on this book decades ago, but you kept setting it aside to work on other projects. So why did you finally decide to concentrate on this big picture look at the Supreme Court? Is it this present moment of uncertainty that I was just describing?
Well, part of it was just feeling like I was getting old and I needed to finish it if it was ever going to get finished. But I do think part of it was fearing that we were about to enter an era where what I saw from the past might no longer be true in the future. So I was eager to describe a history which I think is an edifying story about the court and what it has tried to do, both on the right and the left. If anything, just to help us remember a moment when you could think in this way about the court, because I do fear that we're going to see a different kind of court in the future that might undermine that capacity to see it in that way.
I want to delve into that a little bit, but I also want to ask you about some news from the Supreme Court today, which doesn't maybe directly relate to Roe v. Wade, but maybe could tangentially, and I'll explain. So in a 5-4 decision today, the court's conservative majority overturned a 41-year-old precedent that, as I say, on its face has nothing to do with Roe, but today's ruling means that governments are not immune to being sued in other state courts. And this is a case from the same era as Roe v. Wade. And in the dissent, liberal Justice Stephen Breyer writes today that today's decision can only cause one to wonder which cases the court will overrule next. So, Larry Lessig, let's wonder, do you see a preview of reversals to come in what happened today?
Well, I don't want to comment on the case today because I haven't had a chance to study it. But I will say that, you know, the perspective that I tried to offer in the book is that the court has been very sensitive to being seen as the tool of the political branches, or in particular, the president. The preeminent case in the context of Roe versus Wade, I think, is actually Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a decision in 1992, where most people thought that the Supreme Court was going to overturn Roe versus Wade because it seemed like the conservatives had appointed enough justices to achieve that end. But in a really important joint opinion by Justices Souter, Kennedy, and O'Connor, they basically signaled that they didn't want to be seen to be the kind of tool of the president, and that if we imagined the Supreme Court amending the Constitution through appointments by the president, that would fundamentally undermine the institution of the court. And so that's to say that there's a difference between cases that the court might overturn that are seen to be political in the sense of, you know, like President Trump announcing that he appoints them and then therefore they overturn those decisions, and decisions that, you know, might be overturned because they come to be seen as bad decisions or mistaken decisions or decisions that are no longer in tune with a political era. So I'm quite open to the idea of the court overturning its earlier decisions. I'm very allergic to the idea of the court overturning its political decisions because a president has appointed justices who have promised, whether directly or indirectly, to do exactly that.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that 92 case that you were talking about, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, is this was one of the cases that, of course, cemented Anthony Kennedy, a Republican appointee's status as the swing vote on the Supreme Court. And as you say, he didn't go in the direction that maybe some observers had assumed. And we kind of saw that in a different case today, too, Larry Lessig. And I know that you didn't maybe follow the particulars of today's cases super closely, but we did have another business case today where Trump appointee Brett Kavanaugh sided with the court's four liberal justices today in ruling that consumers can proceed with an antitrust lawsuit against Apple. And so the more predictable outcome would have been that all five conservatives would take a pro-business stance, right? So, I mean, to your point about how the court has historically tried to avoid this perception that they're just a political instrument, I don't know, do we worry too much about that? I mean, can we really make assumptions about how the court is going to rule?
Yeah, I think that we overemphasize the level of politics in the actual decisions of this court, not just this court, but courts historically. You know, most of the decisions are unanimous decisions. And when they're not unanimous, there's often these weird, what, you know, to the simple political frame, these weird alliances. So, you know, we didn't actually know a lot about how Brett Kavanaugh would think about a question like the question of the Apple App Store claim, antitrust claim. And of course, it's a very preliminary stage in that litigation. It's simply the question whether the case can proceed. And it's not surprising to me that, you know, you could see this from both sides, a conservative side and a liberal side. There's no reason why pro-business conservatives should be in favor of monopolies. In fact, to the contrary, they should be skeptical of monopolies. So I think that, you know, there's so much energy to frame everything the court does in a simple left-right metric that we ought to resist that. And we ought to give them some space to do the work of justices, which is to decide cases on the basis of the law and to be free from this constant pull from the political side to, you know, decide them according to the platform of the Republican or Democratic Party.
We're talking about the Supreme Court with Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig. And Larry, I'd love to get your take on the Chief Justice, John Roberts, because some court observers have come to think that perhaps he's the new swing vote on the court, which is perhaps somewhat surprising when you think about it. He's a George W. Bush appointee. But, you know, you could look at, I think, Exhibit A would probably be his 2012 vote to uphold the Affordable Care Act, and that, you know, maybe he's occupying that role that has now been vacated by Anthony Kennedy. What do you think about that theory?
Well, I think that he is among the most interesting justices on the court right now, not just because he's the chief, but not so much because he's playing a swing vote role, but because he seems to be playing a very sensitive institutional role. You know, so what's so striking about that decision upholding Obamacare was that in that opinion, he both articulates a very conservative theory for restricting the scope of Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, but at the same time upholds the Obamacare decision in a way that will avoid making it seem like the court is just behaving in a purely political way. I mean, obviously, if that court had struck down Obamacare for the next election, the whole question would have been this conservative court that's standing up and reversing the signature legislation of this Democratic president. He avoids that. I think he protects the institution of the court by avoiding that. But at the same time, he advances his substantive conservative objective of continuing to articulate a restrictive power for Congress under the Commerce Clause. That's a very subtle move. You know, and in my book, I link it to examples of other really strategically insightful justices, including the very first famous Chief Justice, Chief Justice Marshall, who, when he created the institution of judicial review, did it in a way that protected the institution of the court. And I think that understanding, which is what I'm putting under this framework of constraint, is really central to understanding how the court develops the institution of judicial review and the part that I'm suggesting we need to pay more attention to.
So you mentioned Marshall, and we were just talking about a very contemporary case in 2012. But are there other examples, other cases maybe that you can point to throughout history, Larry Lessig, where you see the court exercising that restraint that you're talking about of, in your view, ruling in a way that seems designed to safeguard the reputation of the institution?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch. One of the most interesting and surprising is a case that doesn't seem like it's restraining, driven by restraint at all. And this is a case where the question the court had was whether Congress could regulate homegrown wheat. The case is Wickard versus Filburn. And it comes after the court has basically signaled that it's no longer going to limit the power of Congress significantly. And in this case, it seems the most extreme it can be because, you know, basically they're saying wheat grown in your on your farm that you don't intend to sell in the market at all still could have an effect on the market. And because if you aggregate all the other people growing wheat at home, it could affect the price of wheat on the market, we will say Congress can regulate it. And when it came down, most people thought, wow, that's really extreme, and that means that Congress has no limit to its power at all. But actually work by scholars behind the scenes has demonstrated that when the court made that judgment, part of the reason it made that judgment was its own recognition that it couldn't draw a more restrictive line in a way that would be consistent and not seem political. Like if you tried to limit it, limit Congress by saying it could go this far but not that far, then whenever it drew a line, people would say, well, you're doing that because you're a conservative court. You're doing that because you're a liberal court. And so the institution itself could not survive drawing what is in effect an economic line using legal terminology. That's the way the court came to understand its limits. So it said, okay, we have to back away and we have to let Congress draw the line because we don't have the capacity ourselves to draw it. That was, I think, a quintessentially institutional perspective.
How about though, what? I guess what I'm wondering is, as you describe this, the thinking in this decision, Larry, is how you're able to use historical clues to reach those conclusions. Because when we see these decisions or dissents, as the case may be, you know, typically the justices are just laying out their best legal arguments. They don't usually write, you know, I voted this way so I wouldn't be seen as a political hack, right? They're not quite so transparent yeah. about it. So how are you piecing together the notion that justices are behaving in a way that has sort of this big picture respect for the institution in mind?
Well, in this case, you know, the scholar Professor Cushman has done the work to reveal through the memos that the justices wrote to each other exactly how they came to see the problem in the underlying statute, why it raised a constitutional question, but ultimately resolve to decide the case in a way that didn't even signal that there was, from their view, any problem with it at all. So there, in that case, it's not my own original work that demonstrates the sensitivity, but the framework I'm offering shows why the work that he has done, reveals a court that is, in this sense, sensitive to its institutional place. We've seen other decisions where the court's much more upfront. There was a period of time where the court had followed the lead of the former Chief Justice Rehnquist to restrict the scope of Congress's regulations of states qua states. This was a federalism doctrine that tried to limit the ability of a federal government to regulate states. And then a short time afterwards, like less than a decade later, the court backs away. And when the court backs away, Justice Blackmun writes an opinion that basically says, look, this is not the sort of question, these limits on the states, that we can decide without invoking deep policy matters, which are just beyond the ken, just beyond the capacity of a court to decide. And so we will retreat because we don't want to be in this position where we essentially seem like we're making political decisions, which are dressed up as judicial decisions. That sensitivity, I think, you can see in the court's doctrines from the very beginning of the court. And what I'm trying to do in this book is to try to give it a frame, give it a way of speaking that makes the practice of the court make more sense, and I think ultimately more edifying for what the institution has been in the history of America.
So let's bring it back to the current court then. I mean, the president seems to think that, you know, a reversal of Roe would be a slam dunk before this court. I mean, what about other ones? I'm thinking of the 2015 ruling that the Constitution guarantees a right to same-sex marriage. You know, the conventional wisdom would be, well, obviously, if they had a chance, the conservative justices on this court would reverse that. Or if there was another case similar to the Heller case from 2008, the Second Amendment case, right, that in which the court interpreted the much-debated language in the Second Amendment as meaning that people have a constitutional right to bear arms unconnected to that well-regulated militia. You know, maybe this court would just expand that and say there's basically no legal gun control. I mean, is that the kind of thing that you foresee, or do you see this court perhaps having the same sort of historical institutional safeguards in mind?
Well, I think that they will always feel the institutional historical constraint, and some of those cases would be easier for them than others. And it's not just historical constraints. So the gay rights cases or the same-sex marriage cases, I don't see there's any plausibility of the court stepping back from that, even though it's a very recent decision. And the reason for that is that it's fundamentally it's fundamentally consonant with what so much of America has come to see. There isn't, you know, when those decisions were made, people predicted a huge political backlash. It just hasn't manifested. And that's a signal that, in fact, a court was speaking for values that had become central to our culture. And that's a good reason to believe the court's not going to go back on it. The Roe decision is more complicated. You know, because Roe has obviously fueled a backlash, and there's been an ongoing political fight by people who in good faith believe that this violates the rights of the unborn, and good people in good faith who believe that not allowing women this right, freedom to choose, violates the right of women. And that genuine contestation leaves the court in a very uncomfortable position because, you know, part of what I'm trying to demonstrate is how the court wants to avoid being in the middle of what seems like these deeply political contests. And so in that case, I could easily see the court following the resolution of the joint opinion in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, where the court said, look, we don't want to be seen as Donald Trump's tool. You know, Donald Trump doesn't get to just appoint the Constitution, doesn't get to say, I appoint these justices, therefore they're going to reverse this decision because that's my values. I could see them deciding it like that. I could also see them writing an opinion that says, look, we've had more than 40 years of struggle because of this opinion, and we're not going to judicialize it anymore. We're going to step back and let the states resolve it themselves without us being in the center of this every single time. But that's because it has this deeply contested political character to it. Unlike, I think, the gay rights or the same-sex marriage cases, which I think have passed that, at least for now. Now, it follows from this, you know, I'm somebody who's been pushing very hard in the area of political campaign finance reform. And obviously, I think that the decision of Citizens United, which, you know, allowed this unlimited spending in the context of independent political action committees, was a terrible decision. It follows from this, I would also say...
Well, can I ask you a little bit about that, Larry? You mentioned Citizens United. You just got me thinking about the 2020 election cycle, where we see Democrats really wrestling with how to handle campaign contributions. And I know this was a big issue for you when you ran briefly for the Democratic nomination in 2016, right? And you mentioned that 2010 landmark Citizens United case. So in the moments we have left, how should Democrats go about wrestling with how they take campaign contributions in this cycle?
Well, I think that the important point for the book, I think, is first of all to say, I don't think that the president should be appointing people to, promising to appoint people who are going to reverse or change the Constitution through those appointments. So I have to constrain myself in that respect, too. Candidates, I think, should be talking about what would actually fix the system, not so much, you know, trying to run a cleaner than thou campaign, you know. So I think the important thing is to talk about what the Supreme Court has allowed, you know, public funding of public elections. We should be talking about how we would establish that in our political system. And that would be much more important than, you know, running for president promising you're not going to take money from corporate PACs or taking money from having independent political action committees supporting you. I think the question is, do you support reform? Will you make reform happen? Not can you run the cleanest campaign of anybody on the stage.
That's Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig. His new book is called Fidelity and Constraint, How the Supreme Court Has Read the American Constitution. Larry, thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, highlights from the first commencement speeches of 2019. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.